From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. When one thinks of the season's best, fruitcake, mince pie, and figgy pudding immediately leap to mind and just as quickly leap away. So perhaps it's time instead to enjoy some of our favorite stories of the year. Coming up on Only a Game, Fenwick War, Jack Kerouac Bobblehead Night, and a history of dueling. Also ahead on Only a Game, a look at the life of Jimmy O'Connell, banished from Major League Baseball in 1924, and an apocalyptic scenario involving the Red Sox and the Cubs in the World Series. Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Iran is appealing for international help to cope with the aftermath of a major earthquake yesterday. Officials say it appears 20,000 people died in the southeastern city of Bam. Jim Muir of the BBC says the rescue workers are overwhelmed.
I'm standing at Bam Airport, normally a very quiet place, but today, of course, it's a complete chaos. There are dozens and hundreds of people being carried through, injured, through the airport, which itself has been damaged in the earthquake, but is still standing, out onto the tarmac, where there are certainly more than a dozen, probably 15 or 16 planes that have come in during the night and yesterday to bring in relief workers and supplies and to take out the wounded. Back in Tehran, there are dozens of ambulances queuing up at the airport there to take the wounded as they're brought in off this air bridge that has been set up, and planes and helicopters taking the injured in there. But here in Bam, as I say, there are dozens of people, a constant stream of people being carried in on blankets, on stretchers, some of them being pushed on luggage trolleys from the airport itself.
The BBC's Jim Muir reporting from Bam. U.S. troops in Iraq came under attack today in the northern city of Mosul. NPR's Julie McCarthy says the troops returned fire.
The U.S. military says that American soldiers killed four insurgents after the troops came under attack from rocket-propelled grenades and small arms fire. Now, this occurred around Mosul, where the 101st Airborne controls a broad patch of territory in the north around that city. The troops were checking for improvised explosive devices, homemade bombs, really, the common weapon of choice that the insurgents have used against the U.S. presence here and against the Iraqis who are cooperating with the Americans. Troops came under attack and returned fire. The staff sergeant said that in that exchange of fire, U.S. troops destroyed a car, and four occupants of that car were killed. Iraqi paramedics were reported to have pulled the charred corpses from the car.
NPR's Julie McCarthy in Baghdad. Nine people are still missing after Thursday's mudslides in Southern California. Seven people died in the mudslides that swept through two camps in Waterman Canyon in the San Bernardino Mountains. The area was considered to be vulnerable to mudslides because wildfires in the fall had destroyed much of the vegetation that would have kept the soil in place. Rescuers will try again today to find three snowboarders trapped by avalanches in northern Utah. Two other snowboarders from the same group were able to dig themselves out after being buried up to their chests. Authorities say there is little hope that the missing boarders are still alive. You're listening to NPR News. Scientists are still trying to find out what happened to Beagle 2, the European-made Mars lander. The $70 million spacecraft entered the Martian atmosphere on Christmas Eve, but all attempts to make contact with the probe have failed. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
European mission managers remain optimistic since there's no firm evidence that Beagle 2 is okay or not. The robot science station was equipped with a landing system similar to the one NASA used on its Mars Pathfinder mission in 1996. Parachutes slow the spacecraft down, and then inflatable airbags form a cocoon around the vehicle as it bounces to a stop on Mars. It's possible that Beagle 2 may have burned up during entry into the Martian atmosphere. It could have crashed, or it could have been blown off course and out of radio range. Another possibility is that its antenna is pointing the wrong way, or something is blocking the signal. Ground controllers will continue looking for Beagle 2 into the new year. Perhaps the best chance to locate the robot is January 4th. That's when the European-built Mars Express spacecraft settles into an orbit that will take the vehicle high over Beagle 2's intended landing site north of the equator. Mars Express is designed to pick up the lander's signal. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Prosecutors in West Palm Beach, Florida, say they've offered a plea agreement to Lionel Tate, sentenced to life in prison for killing a 6-year-old girl when he was 12. That conviction and sentence was overturned by an appeals court. Tate had claimed he accidentally killed the girl while imitating wrestlers he saw on television. He's now 16. Prosecutors say if he pleads guilty to second-degree murder, they'll offer a sentence of 3 years in prison, of which he's already served 33 months. That'd be followed by a year under house arrest and 10 years of probation. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For any baseball fan with an imagination, the best of all playoff outcomes would have been a Cubs-Red Sox World Series. The Red Sox haven't won the championship since 1918. The Cubs have gone without series rings since 1908. Back in October, before the two teams were eliminated from the playoffs in the heartbreaking fashion to which their fans have grown accustomed, we wondered what would have happened had they met in this year's Fall Classic. And we produced this chilling scenario.
Game 7, bottom of the ninth. The Cubs are up 1-0. The Red Sox have the bases loaded with two outs and a 3-2 count on Nomar Garciaparra. Joe Browski pitching from the stretch, and Browski can't stay upright on the mound.
That's got to be a ball.
This wind, this sudden, I don't know what to call it.
A hurricane, a tornado, a typhoon. Oh,
swept Browski off the mound.
Ball.
He's tumbling head over heels across the field, and he disappears into the dugout. That had to hurt.
I don't think he's coming back out.
No, indeed. The bullpen gate is open, and I think we're going to see
a swarm of locusts.
That the pitcher is Todd Wellmeyer, who's only had one save all season. This is a surprise.
They're in my hair.
Wellmeyer's trying to get to the mound, and
the ground has opened up. It's swallowed Wellmeyer.
Looks like Dusty Baker has to make another call to the bullpen. So let's go down to Chet Marks with a lucky fan watching the game from the bleachers. Chet?
I have here, what's your name?
Death.
So, Mr. Death, are you a Sox fan or a Cubs fan?
I'll take them both.
And I see you're here with some friends. What are their names?
This is Pestilence, Famine, and War.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
Hiya.
All right, then. You boys enjoy the game. This is Chet Marks pitching it back upstairs.
Nomar looks determined. A World Series ring is really all his resume lacks.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
What's that glow in the distance?
Please try to leave the park in orderly fashion.
Nomar is fiddling with his batting gloves like an octopus with a rash. Good God, that's annoying.
Up beyond the scoreboard. That glow in the east, coming this way. It's red and orange and angry.
Angry.
It's hail and the fire. It's fire!
Beware, Gate D. There be dragons there. Gate C, blocked by three-headed dogs. Try the charred gap, right field wall. Thank you for coming to Fenway Park. Red Sox remind you to drive home safely.
Of course, the Florida Marlins and the New York Yankees prevented the opening of the ninth gate. However, both the Red Sox and the Cubs should be contenders once again next year. Will there be another opportunity for rivers of blood to flow in the streets and for prophecy to be written in flames across the sky? Probably not. On the evening of August 21st, the Spinners, the single baseball team in Lowell, Massachusetts, enjoyed a standing-room-only crowd. This was not a surprise. The Boston Red Sox minor league affiliate had spun a string of 151 sellouts going into that Thursday night game. But John Good, the director of public relations for the Spinners, was taking nothing for granted. He'd arranged for a promotion in which the ball club would give away bobblehead dolls of one of Lowell's famous native sons. From WBUR in Boston, other fans who didn't know the work of the beat novelist and poet Lowell is proud to call her own were bound to learn something just by being at the game. In addition to the bobblehead giveaway, the Spinners had arranged for John Sampas, Jack Kerouac's brother-in-law and the man in charge of his literary estate, to toss out the ceremonial first pitch. After he'd performed that duty, I caught up with Mr. Sampas under the grandstand, and I asked him if he'd be looking for a giant spike in sales of his brother-in-law's work.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen, although that would be very nice, but I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't go out and buy a new car.
Funny, Jack probably would have, or an old car, maybe, and then he'd have handed the keys to Neil Cassidy, and off they'd have gone, headed at top speed for whatever coast they weren't on. Or at least that's the way it would have been in Kerouac's younger days. But how would the writer, who died in 1969 at the age of just 47, have felt about being memorialized in bobbling plastic? I asked Meg Smith, who's involved in the annual Lowell Celebrates Kerouac Literary Festival, whether the promotion at LaLasher Park might trivialize Kerouac's work. She thought not.
I can understand how some people would have that concern, but the way that I look at it is that Kerouac is as much a part of the popular culture as he is literary culture, if you will. And I think it can be seen as an opportunity to have something tangible to maybe introduce people to his works or get them interested in it. And, you know, certainly for them to see that he actually was a real person, you know, who was born here and lived here. And I think it does add to the fun, actually.
At least as much fun as the Jack dolls was the opportunity to hear the poet over the PA system between innings, though that part of the promotion provoked even more puzzled looks than the giveaway had.
It's been so long since I've been hungry. It's like a miracle. Ah, boy, but them bacon and them egg.
The sports connection, the honoring of Jack Kerouac at, of all places in Lowell, the ballpark, was no stretch, according to Professor Hillary Holliday, who teaches courses that include Jack Kerouac's fiction and poetry at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell.
He was a wonderfully fast typist. He was proud of that. He considered that one of his sporting activities among men.
Right. And he was an athlete.
Yeah. He loved baseball. He invented his own baseball park game. He was a great football player. He was also a track star in high school. And a lot of people did that.
So it kind of makes sense to honor Kerouac at his hometown baseball park.
And this can only help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I assume you'll have a Kerouac bobblehead doll on your desk the next time you lecture about the Dharma bums are on the road.
I may have to glue it down.
She may have to do just that. By the middle innings of that Thursday night game, the Jack Kerouac bobblehead doll was inspiring much talk of commerce. It was beginning to look as if the crystal from Bill Ricca, who'd given up her bobblehead for a copy of On the Road and $5, had been had, at least according to the experience of John Meehan of Lowell, who was offering the Dharma Bums and $10.
No, I haven't found her ticket yet, no. They all want to go out on eBay and sell them out on eBay.
Here we go. Here's a transaction. Come on.
$10.
It's a book.
As of the middle of this week, it looked as if those refusing to deal away their bobbleheads had indeed chosen wisely. Jack Kerouac bobblehead dolls were going for as much as $250 on eBay. And somewhere, one has to suppose, Jack Kerouac is laughing.
Got a girl, take a trip around the world. Goodbye, Jack. I don't look back. Is it yes? Is it no? I don't care. We gotta go. Goodbye, Jack. I don't come back.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Only a Game's theme music was composed by Tom Hedden.
New York and Orlando, Jazz, San Francisco, goodbye, Jack. Kerouac. Wheels and a rosary. God is my destiny. Goodbye, Jack. I don't look back. Bonsoir et bon nuit. Kissing me, my chérie. Goodbye, Jack.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In a sudden-death overtime following two brutal 10-minute chukkas, England won the World Elephant Polo Championships at the Tip Top's Jungle Lodge in the Royal Chitwan National Park in Nepal. The 22nd edition of the spectacle drew a crowd of 8,000, and the tournament took a week to complete. The rules of elephant polo are similar to those defining the game played by men on horseback, except that the field is smaller and each elephant polo player is aided by a driver, or mahout, who knows the elephant and can steer the animal more or less in pursuit of the ball. Etiquette requires that players swap elephants at halftime, and it forbids the beasts from picking up the polo ball with their trunks. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, stories of the duel, both horrifying and absurd. But first, 13 years ago, Margaret Laybourne, who was 65 years old at the time, wrote me a long letter explaining that she was the niece of a former ballplayer named Jimmy O'Connell, whom Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis had banned from organized baseball in 1924. In her letter, Ms. Laybourne referred to the newspaper clippings that documented her uncle's prowess and his disgrace. She said Jimmy's widow had ordered the clippings burned, but, well, truth being stranger than fiction...
My cousin gave me some of these clippings this summer. She had hoodwinked my aunt, and the paper she watched burned was actually bags of other clippings exchanged on the way out to the ash pit for the bag of O'Connell clippings. Are you interested in this story?
I was interested, but I was interested in a lot of stories. Margaret Laybourne's letter about her uncle, the ex-ball player, found its way to the bottom of the pile on my desk. And then this past spring, she wrote me again regarding the same matter, Jimmy O'Connell.
I am now 78 years old, and I still think we should tell his story, because he's always been my hero, our family's hero, and we always felt that he got a very bum rap. And we always wanted his story to be told again so that he could be considered as the great ball player and wonderful human being that he was.
Jimmy O'Connell first gave promise of being a great ballplayer when he broke into the Pacific Coast League with the San Francisco Seals in 1919. He was a big enough star so that when he left the team for a day under temporarily mysterious circumstances, his departure made the San Francisco papers.
James J. O'Connell left Sacramento yesterday under the pretext that he was ill. But today it was learned authentically that the reason for his absence was a matter of signing a life contract. The marriage of O'Connell will not interfere with his presence in the lineup tomorrow when the Seals meet Los Angeles in one of the crucial series of the year. It was announced by Jack Miller, manager of the Seals.
According to Margaret Laybourne, my initial source for all matters relating to Jimmy O'Connell and to Margaret's sister, Mary Maffeo, the marriage followed directly from O'Connell's choice of career.
They fell instantly in love. She was a beautiful Irish girl, and he was a big, handsome Irish ball player. It was a perfect match.
She was a little bit of a flapper, too. That was the flapper age. Yes,
if Esther Doran O'Connell was, in fact, a bit of a flapper, she must have been delighted with the circumstance that did eventually interfere with Jimmy O'Connell's presence in the lineup of the San Francisco Seals. In 1922, young O'Connell's talent, which earned him comparisons to Babe Ruth, caught the attention of New York Giants manager John McGraw. And the Giants bought the San Francisco Stars contract from the Seals for $75,000. At the time, a record sum for a minor league player. Jimmy and his bride moved to New York and the big leagues. Flapper heaven. O'Connell's arrival did not go unnoticed.
Well, I have an Al Jolson story. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Esther said that they loved going to nightclubs. And they went to a nightclub one night where Al Jolson was performing, and he flashed the spotlight on them and said, "Folks, here's Jimmy O'Connell. He hit a home run today, and you ain't seen nothing yet."
Wait a minute, I tell you, you ain't heard nothing. Toot, 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 tee. Goodbye. Don't cry.
Al Jolson's endorsement notwithstanding, Jimmy O'Connell did not immediately eclipse Babe Ruth. John McGraw rarely gave rookies much playing time, no matter what they'd cost the ball club. O'Connell's job with the Giants was to sit and listen and learn. Unhappily, late in the autumn of his second season, he listened to the wrong guy or guys before he'd learned enough to brush them off. Allegedly at the behest of Coach Cozy Dolan, Jimmy O'Connell committed baseball's unforgivable indiscretion. His Giants needed just one more win over the last few games of the season to grab the National League pennant. They were playing the Philadelphia Phillies, a seventh-place club that year. Before the game, Jimmy O'Connell walked across the infield and began a conversation with an old San Francisco friend named Heinie Sand, now employed by the Woeful Phils. According to subsequent testimony from Sand, the conversation went something like this.
Jimmy O'Connell asked me what our club thought of his club in winning the pennant. I said to him, "Why, I hope the best club wins, Jimmy."
That is not it. How do you fellows feel towards us winning the pennant?
I don't know. I would like to see it end up in a tie.
Would $500 change your opinion, Heinie?
Jimmy, I am not interested.
All right, Heinie. This is just between you and I. It needn't go no further. You go out there and do your best.
It needn't go no further, Jimmy is alleged to have said, and perhaps it wouldn't have if he'd made his proposal in, say, 1917 or 1918. Baseball's early days were full of fixes and dumped games, but the infamous Black Sox scandal in 1919 and the monstrous publicity it generated changed everything. Concerned that fans would eventually turn away from baseball unless they felt the players could be trusted, the major league owners hired Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis as the game's first commissioner. They gave Landis not only a lifetime appointment, but the discretion to operate without restraint. Well aware that at least one of the infamous Black Sox, Buck Weaver, had been banished from baseball not because Weaver played to lose, but simply because he did not report the scheme his teammates had embraced, Heinie Sand sang. Within a matter of hours, word of Jimmy O'Connell's $500 proposition made its way to Landis. The judge took a train to New York and checked into room 670 at the Waldorf Astoria. David Pietruscia, author of Judge and Jury, a recent biography of Landis, maintains that the subsequent meeting between the judge and the young ballplayer was both straightforward and bizarre.
Landis brings O'Connell into testify in a hotel room in New York City, and O'Connell does something just as amazingly stupid as attempting to bribe Heinie Sand, is he readily admits it to Landis. And Landis admits later on, if O'Connell had simply denied it, it would have been he said, he said. He would not, as a judge, as a commissioner, had enough evidence to support banning this young fellow from baseball.
In a newspaper article written some years after O'Connell's banishment, Jimmy's father acknowledged, "It was the way I reared him. I wanted him to represent the highest ideal in manhood. I taught him to tell the truth at any cost. Even when I would question him about boyish pranks, he'd never tell a lie. That's how he used to escape chastisement." The tale, as Jimmy O'Connell told it to Judge Landis, had New York coach Cozy Dolan originating the scheme and several Giants veterans, Frankie Frisch, Ross Youngs, and George Kelly, encouraging O'Connell to offer $500 to Heinie Sand. Dolan, like O'Connell, was called before the commissioner. They met on September 30, 1924, at which point Cozy Dolan claimed that he remembered nothing. 4 days later, the story had broken in the papers, and no less an eminence than columnist Damon Runyon was anxious to tell the tale.
I had a long talk this morning with Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis about the baseball scandal. If you have never seen the boss of Big League Baseball, his manner is vehement, explosive, earnest. It was all three at once when I asked him this question. What was your final reaction to the thing? He leapt to his feet, pointing a long, skinny finger at me, almost accusingly. "The appalling stupidity of it," he replied. "It left me dazed." In a pantomime, the judge enacted Cozy Dolan's attitude about the inquiry. The judge, and he's a pretty good actor, looked at the floor, looked at the ceiling, rumpled his hair, rubbed his chin, all this being Dolan, you understand, then finally said, quoting Dolan, "I don't remember." The judge glared at the writer for several minutes as if to let Dolan's statement sink in. Then he continued, "But Cozy," I said to him, "today is Tuesday. This is supposed to have happened Saturday. Just last Saturday. Think." The judge resumed his pantomime portrayal of Dolan pondering the question. Then he replied again, "I don't remember." Why, it was worse than if he confessed outright.
In short order, Landis banned Cozy Dolan, who had admitted nothing, from baseball. He also banished Jimmy O'Connell, who had admitted everything. Frisch, Youngs, and Kelly, all eventually elected to baseball's Hall of Fame, denied any involvement or knowledge of the misadventure, though Frisch and Youngs suggested that the whole affair might have been a joke. Landis summoned neither John McGraw nor anyone else from Giants management. Landis biographer David Pietruscia isn't surprised.
What is Landis's mission? Landis's mission is to promote the best interests of baseball. It is not to promote justice necessarily. It is to promote the best interests of baseball. So when the thing starts to stink to high heaven, as in the Black Sox, and when the whole structure may totter and crash because of it, then you come in and you come in hard and you make sure everybody understands what the rules are. But once the basic structure is preserved, then you can loosen the reins. And that's what Landis basically does.
On the day Jimmy O'Connell offered Heine Sand $500, New York beat the Phils 5-1 to clinch the pennant. Heine Sand scored Philadelphia's run. The Giants were headed for the World Series. Landis's discipline had cost the club nothing more than a coach and a utility player, but Jimmy O'Connell was lost. According to a New York Times story that appeared on October 3, 1924, the day after he was banned from baseball, Jimmy O'Connell didn't know where else to go but the polo grounds.
The appearance of O'Connell at the polo grounds yesterday morning was a dramatic one. He was one of the first players to arrive. He did not attempt to put on a uniform for the practice, but stood around, his head bowed. O'Connell was called into McGraw's office.
Well, what have you to say, Jimmy?
I don't know what to say.
How did you ever get yourself into a thing like this?
I don't know.
Then, breaking down, he threw himself into a chair, buried his head in his hands, and sobbed.
I can't go home. I can't go home.
According to Jimmy O'Connell's niece, Margaret Laybourne, Jimmy's young wife, Esther, shared his shame.
And Esther was so private, and she was so humiliated by the episode. Well, they approached the hotel and saw all the reporters out there, and Esther didn't want to face them, so they went across the street, I believe, to Central Park and found a park bench and cuddled there all night until the reporters were gone early in the morning and they were able to go back to the hotel.
Jimmy and Esther O'Connell eventually returned to Sacramento, to the home Seals fans had bought for him when he'd signed with the Giants. Having spent a couple of years waiting in vain for a pardon from Landis, Jimmy and Esther found their way to Fort Baird, New Mexico, where Jimmy played for a team in an outlaw circuit, the Copper League. There, again, Jimmy O'Connell excelled. Among his most enthusiastic fans were the veterans in the Fort Baird Tuberculosis Hospital. O'Connell's games were piped into the wards for bedridden convalescents. According to Tucson, Arizona librarian Lynn Bevel, who spoke to some of Fort Baird's former fans for his master's thesis on the Copper League, Jimmy was widely admired.
O'Connell became a coach and a manager for the players around there and just became an idol. You could hear it in the voices and you could see it in the faces when these men would start talking about O'Connell. They really looked up to him. He was the hero.
Jimmy O'Connell was not the only banned player who found a baseball home in the Outlaw Copper League. Buck Weaver and Chick Gandel of the notorious Black Sox played there as well. According to Copper League historian Lynn Bevel, Gandel, who'd also been a bare-knuckle prize fighter in his younger days, was responsible for O'Connell's most memorable day in the league.
If you know a little of the background of Chick, he has quite a reputation, and I guess he ragged on Jimmy pretty bad. This went on for several weeks, and I guess at some point Jimmy turned on him, because Jimmy was everyone I've talked to said he was just an exceedingly nice person. I mean, well-mannered, just a delight. And he turned on Chick and said, you know, I think there's only room for one player on this team, and it's not going to be you. And he picked up a baseball bat, and according to the bat boy, Thomas Foy, who I talked with, he literally chased him out of Fort Baird and up past the main gate, and Chick did not come back.
Jimmy O'Connell remained in Fort Baird until 1936, when he returned to California and took a job with Atlantic Richfield as a shopkeeper. That was when his niece, Margaret Laybourne, had her only opportunity to see her uncle play ball.
So I saw him hit one of his famous home runs.
Were you reminded instantly of Babe Ruth?
No, I was only thinking of Jimmy O'Connell. Babe Ruth was just kind of a ghost to me, but oh, when I saw him playing ball, it was the thrill. And I was 11.
Jimmy O'Connell died at the age of 75 on November 11th, 1976. His obituary in the Bakersfield Californian was 28 lines long. It included the time and place of his funeral service, named his survivors, and offered the information that he'd been a member of the Knights of Columbus for 54 years. There was no mention of baseball. According to historian David Pietrucha, probably nobody will ever know whether LaFaire Jimmy O'Connell was in fact an attempt to fix a game through bribery or the disastrous misfiring of an exceptionally cruel and stupid practical joke on a naive kid or some combination of blunders even more incomprehensible.
The question which is never asked is, where is the $500 coming from? Is it coming from the coach, Cozy Dolan, who does seem to be involved in some way? Is Giants ownership involved? Is John McGraw involved? Later on, you find out that John McGraw hires an attorney for Cozy Dolan. He should be very mad at Cozy Dolan, because if you follow the whole thing to its logical conclusions, there are no logical conclusions or logical beginnings to it, more to the point. That here was a fellow who was not very bright, evidently, and may have taken things too far. But the basic plot makes no sense. As somebody said, I think it was McGraw, pay the Phillies to lose? They do that all year for free.
Some of the questions are intriguing, but for Jimmy O'Connell's nieces, sisters Margaret Laybourne and Mary Maffeo, they have faded, and they are beside the point.
I think that all life stories are truly mysterious, and I think that this story has had lots of different versions, but the true story was that it was a lifelong love affair, and baseball was part of it, and I'm glad it's part of baseball history.
Our story about Jimmy O'Connell was produced by Karen Given. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Wayland Avenue. Reverse the curse, Bailey! The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Goal! The Bulls win!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports. And maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, sorting out the week from the geeks in Pensic War. But first, in Gentleman's Blood, subtitled A History of Dueling, From Swords at Dawn to Pistols at Dusk, Barbara Holland writes, quote, "There was much to like about the duel, and she celebrates the one-on-one sword or gunfight as, quote, an improvement over the informal ambush or sending henchmen to break the enemy's skull by night on the highway." In October, Barbara Holland joined me from her home in Virginia for further discourse on dueling throughout history. In her book, Holland wrote of her own diminished, dueling-deprived days that the confrontational glory is gone, and that was the whole point. She explained to me why our current games of confrontation are a poor substitute for the duel.
So impersonal, for heaven's sake. I mean, they may cheer a lot, but nobody expects that the members of one basketball team personally want to kill or even injure the members of the opposing basketball team. I mean, the personal element is gone, if you know what I mean.
Well, I know what you mean because I've read your book. Insults have a great deal to do with duels, personal insults, not just the standard sort of trash talking.
Yes, of course. And if you were really touchy, especially, say, the maybe 18th century French, for instance, you could insult somebody just by looking funny at his hat or his beard or something like that, and he would have to challenge you. And naturally, you would have to meet him, or everybody would call you a coward and a poltroon. A lot of people got killed that way.
Yeah, and sometimes the wrong guy got killed. I mean, sometimes the person delivering the insult was victorious in the duel, and everybody went away happy anyway.
I know. This is very hard to figure out. Samuel Johnson brooded about it. But the way everybody talks about the glorious chance to wash away this stain on your honor, you'd think that the offended man always won. But no. I mean, first you insult the man, then you go out and kill him, adding injury to insult.
So to speak.
Really, it was most unfair, but people convinced themselves it was fair somehow.
Your book is full of lively accounts of remarkable duels. One of my favorites comes quite early in the text. Tell us the story of the man who faced a greyhound on the dueling ground.
Uh-huh. Well, the greyhound was the only witness to his master's murder. And what was the man's name? Mackay, I believe, mm-hmm. who killed the greyhound's master. And the greyhound went promptly back into Paris and went to the home of a friend of his master's and led the friend to where the body was buried and scratched at the ground. And the body was dug up and decently reburied, and the greyhound moved in with the friend. And every time in social life it happened to see or run across the murderer, it was a very gentle and well-behaved dog on the whole, and it flew right at him, and it would take two or three guys to haul him off. So this was reported to the king, and the king decided this was definitely an accusation, and there would have to be a trial by combat. So the murderer was armed, and the greyhound just had his usual weapons, and they went to the appointed place with witnesses and so on, and the greyhound flew at the man and grabbed him around the throat, and the man said, pull him off, and I'll confess, and he confessed, and was hanged on the gibbet and disemboweled, and everybody agreed that justice had been done.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
One of the more bizarre duels that you describe, this one involving two human beings and no dogs, but it did draw quite a crowd. It occurred at an altitude of about 2,500 feet back in 1808, and it was not, I gather, altogether sporting.
Well, no, but perhaps they hadn't laid down the rules carefully enough ahead of time. But anyway, they disagreed over a lady and decided that since they had elevated minds, they would fight an elevated duel. So they went up in two hot air balloons with blunderbusses. And when they had risen to a sufficient altitude, the first man fired at the other man and missed. And the second man, which really does not seem the least bit sporting, fired at the very much larger target of the chap's balloon. And so the fellow and his second fell and were dashed to pieces on the housetops, and the victor sailed some 20 miles away outside of Paris and landed unhurt.
As you say, perhaps the rules should have stipulated that one couldn't shoot the other guy's vehicle out from over him.
Exactly. I mean, most people played according to the code duello, but it doesn't mention hot air balloons.
You did, obviously, voluminous research, as the cliche has it, to write this book, and it must have been great fun. Have you a favorite encounter among all the encounters in Gentleman's Blood?
I particularly like, what was his name, Sainte-Foy, a Frenchman who was famous for many, many duels. And he walked up to a guardsman, and he told the guardsman that he smelled like a goat, and the guardsman challenged him. And Sainte-Foy said, "Put up your sword, you idiot. If you kill me, you will not smell any better, and if I kill you, you will soon smell much worse."
Barbara Holland is the author of Gentleman's Blood, A History of Dueling from Swords at Dawn to Pistols at Dusk, published by Bloomsbury. Miss Holland, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
For every boy who ever dreamed of being a knight in shining armor, and every girl who enjoyed dressing up like a princess, we've got the sport for you. Last summer, Only a Games, Karen Given visited Cooper's Lake Campground in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, and she brought back this story.
This is another world. As you get close to Penzic, you can smell it in the air, you can feel it.
Every year, during the first 2 weeks in August, Paul Lamhut leaves his mundane desk job behind and travels here to the banks of Interstate 79 between Pittsburgh and Erie, Pennsylvania, to enter the past, where he's better known as Lord Aaron the Arrowsmith.
You get your campsite set up, and all of a sudden people are yelling at you, "You're not in garb yet. Why aren't you in garb yet? You know, come on down, be part of the game."
The game is a war put on by the Society for Creative Anachronism, a group dedicated to the study and recreation of the Middle Ages. More than 12,000 people don period clothing and travel here from all over the world to share their study of history, costuming, dance, and of course, the martial arts.
Archers, you may knock!
Medieval tournaments featured archery and fencing, as well as knights in armor sparring one-on-one. Penzic has its share of those sports, but the main feature of the war is something unseen in ancient times, huge armies fighting in a simulated war. Instead of swords, these fighters use sticks made of rattan, a cousin of bamboo used to make furniture. One good blow to the head or the body, and a fighter is supposed to fall over and play dead, which is a good theory, say Anthony and Cole, two mercenary fighters from Nashville, Tennessee.
It's all based on honor system. Your opponent's supposed to take the shots.
And you do that?
Most of the time.
85%, 90%,
maybe.
Yeah,
your adrenaline gets going, and you're,
it's kind of tough.
Woohoo! And
now, a couple battles here, where now it's like, hello? Was that not good on your neck?
Hey ho, for the king marching mighty before us. Hey ho,
the Kingdom of Calantir joins more than 1,000 members and allies of the Eastern Army on a battleground roughly an eighth of a mile long. This morning, 2,000 fighters will engage in a war that's been going on for 32 years. In the early days, the kingdoms of the East and the Midrealm fought over which would be forced to rule over Pittsburgh. But today, they fight for something they say is more important, bragging rights. The armies line up on either side of 5 simulated bridges, indicated by hay bales on the ground. At the cannon blast, the battlefield erupts in a storm of clanging sticks, shields, and metal armor. Johannes, one of the King's Guard of Eldemir, known to the rest of the world as Ontario, falls early and joins the crowd at the sidelines for a little play-by-play.
This is a pretty good-natured battle, I think. You know, we're definitely going to be... Oh, and we... I'm sorry, we are just eating them alive all of a sudden. Eldemir! That was a rush. That was one of the best rushes I think I've ever seen. That was terrific.
But, okay, the best rushes you've ever seen, and you move forward, what, 8 feet?
I actually moved forward about 15 feet. But when you consider, on the other side of that rush was, you know, so the combined weight of about 60 people, each wearing anywhere between 30 and 70 pounds of armor, all of them with long pokey things and big sticks they're trying to hit you with. It's pretty impressive, and you're doing it across a frontage of 18 feet.
Sir Strom, the Baroness Cinnabar, rules over Ann Arbor, Michigan, for the King of the Midrealm. A veteran of 13 years, Strom can tell you that the gleaming metal armor covering him from head to toe is in the Cherburg style of the 1360s. Just don't ask him who's winning.
I'm not even sure. I think they are, yeah. I think by a point or two.
Does it matter?
No. To me, to us, no.
But you're a baron.
Yes, I am.
I
care enough that my guys all fight. I care enough that my region that I command all fights and has fun. I care that no one gets hurt. You know, if I'm having fun, it really doesn't matter if I win or lose.
That's good, because the Midrealm isn't just losing by a point or two. They've failed to win a single point thus far, and if they don't turn today's battle around, the war will be lost, leaving the Eastern fighters positively triumphant.
His Majesty was at the forefront the whole time. He has slain so many enemies, the blood of them has blinded him temporarily. Good luck to all his Majesty! Wassail, Her Majesty!
Wassail!
Wassail me!
Wassail!
They say that Penzic is either muddy or hot, and this year it's been both. After 6 days of rain during the first week of war, the sun has already baked the ground dry and dusty. It's humid, and the heat index is rising steadily into the hundreds. One fighter says on a day like today, armor makes you feel like you're wearing a fur coat with a trash can over your head. It helps when you don't have to add pounds of heavy medieval clothing to the mix. Wearing leathers and skins and covered in tattoos, the Tuchuk look more like barbarians than medieval knights. And it's not until the sun is set in the marketplace that I'm able to find out who they are.
What is a Tuchuk? Oh, that's a long story. Not just well sit down, it's going to be a while.
Xenon Shadowbear, the war chieftain of the Wolverine, explains that Tuchuks are a group based on the fantasy novel The Nomads of Gore, and they've been playing this game for 31 years. Xenon's been fighting since he was 15 and proudly displays a large tattoo of a Tuchuk symbol on the left side of his chest. When I ask where he's from, he says the flatlands over there and points towards Pittsburgh. When I ask what he does when he's not being a Tuchuk, the answers get even more cryptic.
I was born this way, love.
What do you do when you're not carrying a big stick?
Carry a smaller stick.
Xenon finally admits that he designs and manufactures wheelchairs, like the one he uses to get around. And when he lists the injuries that will keep him out of tomorrow's battle, the one that put him in the wheelchair doesn't even come close to making the list.
My shoulder's blowed up. My elbow's kind of bad, and this wrist is kind of shot. And I got rolled over about 9 years ago into this shoulder when I was out fighting, so it's a little bit blowed out, too. But I should be back in shape by next year.
The safety-conscious fighters of the SCA disapprove of many Tuchuk battlefield tactics, and the society's history buffs dislike the group's penchant for fantasy fiction. But none of these arguments get in the way of Xenon's love of the fight.
When I get really fed up and tired and really want to just rip out at the world, I'll call one of my close brothers. And I'll say, you know, hey, why don't we hang out in your backyard for a little while? We'll put on our armor, beat the snot out of each other. And when we're good and tired and we've had our regressions taken out and we're able to lay in the field and drink beer with each other and look at the stars and really be happy, then it's right. And that's how we do it.
Form a family! Woo!
Fighters and supporters show up early for the field battle, the final contest of the war. John, a commander for the Kingdom of Ethelmark, gives his army some last-minute encouragement.
Trust me. I'll be leading the three columns over from the center. Trust me, we'll get into the fight. We ain't going to hold back while the battle rages.
The East has already won the war, and some of its allies have changed sides to try to give the Midrealm a fighting chance. The fact that there's nothing left to win or lose doesn't diminish anyone's excitement.
This battle, though, of course, is one of the staples, where both armies line up on either side, look at each other, and get an adrenaline rush as they close in. It's just something you have to see, that there's 800-900 people over there this morning that want to put a stick to your head, and you realize that they don't have a chance.
I
As a bugle plays in the distance, the lumbering armies move forward just a few feet and stop.
Hey, look, they're using our plan.
Fighters stare at each other across a dusty field. After a while, a commander from the mid thinks he has the solution. Eventually, the Eastern Army's right flank loses patience, and the battle begins.
Remember, one big drift, bro!
Once again, it's the Eastern Army that's left standing, ensuring that the Midrealm won't win a single melee battle point during this war. But the fighters line up for the excessively pointless final battle anyway, to see if the East can make it a clean sweep. Rolf Eichmann, a 17-year veteran from Kansas City, doesn't seem to mind.
It never gets boring.
You never get tired of all the bruises and the heat and the...
And the butterflies and the excitement and the adrenaline, nope.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania.
Andre has a red flag, Chiang Ching's is blue. They all have hills to fly them on, except for Lin Tai Yu. Dressing up in costumes, playing silly games. Hiding out in treetops, shouting out rude names.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from a fighter on the field of Penzic. He doesn't worry about going into battle.
Oh, it's probably the safest war zone you could ever be in.
It sure is, unless, of course, you can't name every character in Star Trek and The Lord of the Rings. Then things could get ugly.
Well, you don't know who Boromir is?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.